once more unto the breach, dear friends.
Else fill up the wall with our English dead.
Good morning again, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and welcome to another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach. And by exciting, I mean to us. You may all have bits of sleepiness, but I have heard that we have recently been prescribed in our podcast for insomnia. Yes. We'll wait to see if the FDA approves us for such. The SEC does not approve us. I have to say that. I'm getting our disclosures out of the way in that reverse order with no context, just saying it really loud instead of in monotone to see what happens. What does that mean? Well, the Personal Wealth Coach is also an SEC-registered investment advisory firm. It's the name of this program, and the people on the program are the same people over in that business. Why is that? Because it really is a good name for both a business and a radio program. But just because it's registered with the SEC to give investment advice, fiduciary investment advice, in the best interest of our clients, it doesn't mean that the SEC is going to give any kinds of a thumbs up. Why do I say that? Number one, the SEC wants everybody to know that, and I think that's important. And number two is there's a good reason for them to want that. If people go around saying, yeah, I'm approved by the government, it might have a little bit of extra meaning, particularly in this era. So, or maybe in other eras, it may have meaning of get out of here, you're the government. And it might have meaning of, oh, you are extra safe. Either way, what we're saying is they're the folks that regulate us. If we say something that's absurd and insane, well, that's just normal. But if we say something dangerous that needs reporting, they're the ones to do it to or with or from. What is the preposition for that?
I think the entire sentence probably needs to be rebuilt.
Yes. There is a sentence structure problem. We cannot diagram it. Go back to the drawing board.
Right.
All right. Would you like to do the next?
They are the ones to whom you should report it.
Well, see, they've even changed that so that dangling participles are okay now.
I know, but I don't like them.
You just don't like to dangle.
No.
Okay.
The information we present on this radio program has been obtained from sources we deem to be reliable. I see I got to use deem.
Yeah.
But we make no warranty or guarantee as to the accuracy or completeness of said information. You like that?
Oh, that was fantastic. So basically what we just said is we think this stuff is all right, but we're not sure.
Right. We're not sure about much of anything. That's the thing about being an economist. You just don't know. And actually, if economists were to give you an honest answer to any economics question,
it would always start with, I don't know.
I don't really know, but.
and in some ways, it's like asking a grandmaster chess player when they're looking at the chessboard, what is absolutely the best move? They will always answer, I don't know, but I like this one over here. So the more you know about something, the less sure you are about how right you are.
Unless you're a politician.
Well, that and implies that they know something.
Well, okay.
Yeah, see.
Politics.
Shameful. We're already trashing the government.
The government.
All right.
Well, we had a stock market this week.
Yes. So have we even said who we... I mean, Jeff and Jake McClure were the bald duo. Jeff McClure, just as a side note, besides spiritually, is not Jake McClure's brother. Jeff McClure is Jake McClure's father. Do you like how I talk in the third person there?
I like that.
This is Jake McClure speaking.
And this is Jeff McClure speaking.
You can tell us apart very easily by the color of our beards.
Right.
So as you're listening, just listen for the color. He's got a much whiter beard than I do. And so just if you hear a darker beard talking, it's Jake. If it's a whiter beard talking, it's Jeff.
They could call me White Beard and call you Black Beard.
Yar.
Well, the stock market happened this week, as it usually does. We use the S&P 500 stock index to track the stock market because we think that's probably a little more accurate than the 30 stocks in the Dow Jones Industrial Average. in some ways, it's more accurate than the total stock market index. Anyway, it is October. It is fairly early in October. And the last part of September and the beginning of October historically have been very turbulent periods in the stock market. It's very rare that we have a year where things don't get really weird and crazy in the stock market in September and October. And there's lots of papers been written on that and why it happens, but it's happening again this year. The
We can talk about that later. Actually, there's a really good behavioral reason why it happens, and it's worth talking about. Just
right.
Not in the middle of the discussion on what happened this week.
So the market was wobbly this week. It went up and down and up and down, and mostly the first part of the week it was down, and the last part of the week it was up. It really boiled down to the fact that we haven't started earnings reports for the third quarter yet. And so, and earnings reports ultimately drive the market. And since we don't have earnings reports, but the quarter's over, so we can't really speculate about what the quarter's going to do because it's already done it, the traders on Wall Street start looking at something else, and Congress gave them something to look at, which is the upcoming debt ceiling debacle that was very, very worrisome for a while and still is, particularly with the Secretary of the Treasury, Janet Yellen, who has a great deal of credibility on Wall Street, saying that if the debt ceiling day came and went and Congress had not acted to raise the debt ceiling, it would be a catastrophe and would throw us back into recession, which had some people worried.
Yeah.
Good cause. Well,
and, I mean, just to throw this in some detail, throughout the last several weeks, we have gotten nearly daily emails from trading platforms talking about how to handle a possible default of interest payments on U.S. government debt, and how their system would handle it, and how they would process things. And so they were just organizing and logistic making, preparing for the government to default, which,
and it still could do it this year.
Yeah. And we just got till December at this point, and we've just had a new vow from Senator McConnell that the Republicans will not participate in raising the debt ceiling in December. So,
of course, he also promised that this time around too.
That's true, and you can tell that a politician is lying because his mouth is moving. In this case, he didn't actually move his mouth. This was a written statement. You can tell he is lying because he is lying.
Well, I don't know if he's lying.
Well, I'm saying that I could say the same about every politician. McConnell at this point, Pelosi in the next sentence.
Okay.
I am an equal opportunity trash talker.
Accuser.
To the politicians.
Accuser.
Yes, I will accuse them all.
Well, the market, the stock market, again, using the S&P 500, wobbled quite a lot. But for the week ending October 8th, which was yesterday, it stabilized on Thursday and Friday, and it closed at 4391.34, up 0.79% for the week. Which ain't half bad. You multiply that times 52, we're headed in the right direction. It's down about 3% from its high in early September. And as a matter of fact, if you look at the trailing 90 days, and it's up, almost not up. It's basically flat for the trailing 90 days. But it has about a 16.91% gain this year, which is really good. The CRSP Mid-Cap Value Index, where we also track because it track something other than the large cap growth stocks that drive the S&P 500, did better. It rose 1.09% for the week. It's at 2471.56, and it's up 20.46% this year and about 1% below its record high. There's a rotation been reported as going on, and I think it's really going on, which is that
I wondered why it was getting so dizzy. Is that the rotation has begun?
Yep.
Okay,
yep.
Go ahead.
What was the rotation? The large cap growth stocks have been getting the money for quite a while, and they have become a bit overpriced in the market, in our opinion. But when you see the market take a dip, it's mostly the large cap tech growth stocks that are being sold. And apparently a significant amount of that money is rotating down or being used to buy smaller companies, smaller capitalization companies on Wall Street, that are value-oriented. In other words, companies that aren't dependent upon much higher revenue in the future and much higher gains and much higher profits in the future, but rather when you look at their assets, and if you broke up the company and you sold the pieces, it'd be worth more than the stock is worth. So we think that is a positive move. It in, generally, towards the end of a major bull market before it turns into a disaster, before it turns into a bear market, you see a tremendous amount of money flowing into the high-tech growth stocks. And the money is simply not accumulated in the value stock. The value stocks are withering away, and the growth stocks are getting all the money, and the price-to-earnings ratio goes crazy, and we're not seeing that. So that's good. The yield on the U.S. Treasury 10-year note. Now, this is significant. It rose about 10% for the week. It's now 1.607. The threat of default obviously caused caused people to back out of treasuries, which causes the interest rate to rise. And the reduced unemployment rate that came out, 4.8%, which we'll talk about later, also suggested that the Fed would pretty quickly start moving to cut the stimulus money, stop buying bonds, which will cause interest rates to rise and bond prices to fall. So the market's getting ahead of that and beginning to start it before the Fed does anything, which is typical behavior, pretty standard. The 30-year bond, interestingly enough, which has stayed through the pandemic below 2%, almost the whole thing, is now at 2.163%. Now, what does that mean? Why is that important? Historically, the steeper the yield curve, in other words, if we start at the 90-day T-bill, which is effectively at 0%, and you go out to the 30-year Treasury, which is currently 2.163, the greater the rise along that path, the greater the difference between short-term and long-term interest rates, the better the economy does for a year to 18 months later. Why is that? Well, because if there's demand for loan, interest rates go up, and there's demand for loans, it means that businesses and large-scale borrowers are borrowing money to buy stuff to make the economy better. And that means that the people who have their finger on the pulse of the economy, the companies that actually make and sell things, are saying, we see a lot of demand. We see a lot of money. We see a lot of opportunity here, and we want to invest our money. We want to borrow some money so that we can buy new equipment and build new buildings and things like that. So the steeper the yield curve, the better the future looks for the economy, and the yield curve is getting pretty steep. You had your hand up.
Yeah, I was just going to just real quick. This is one of the things that I hear more confusion from the general public on this financial concept than on any other financial concept, and that's interest rates and how they affect bonds. Interest rates and why they go up when they go up. And you just covered it lightly, but I think a really good way of looking at it is if you think of yourself as the borrower and you're borrowing for a mortgage, it's a lot easier to understand all of it. Instead of yourself, it's either the U.S. government or a financial organization of some kind, or you know, a company, Ford or whatever. They want to borrow money. So the same way you want to borrow money for your house, if you have good credit, that's quite helpful. We all understand that. The same thing happens with when we're talking about a government or a company or a municipality. Doesn't matter. When you're looking at, hey, should someone loan me money? I've made my payments on time. For some reason, they like to hear that you make your payments on time. Just keep that in mind. When someone wants to loan you money, making payments on time makes them like you more. Okay. So when there are 12 different banks that want to give you a mortgage and they are in competition, they really want your mortgage. They know that there are other banks trying to get your money because they're right in the thick of it. And so they have to lower their interest rate. This is how they're getting paid. There's a lot of money ready to be loaned out. 12 different banks want to do it. You've got good credit. All right, we'll lower our interest rate. Well, they're lowering theirs. Okay, we'll lower ours more. So the more money that's available to loan and the less people either qualified or wanting a loan, the lower the interest rate. When you have more people wanting loans and less people willing to lend, interest rates go up. So when we see interest rates rising, what we're seeing is that more people are borrowing than loaning from just a moment before. If interest rates are higher, there's more people borrowing or less money to loan, or both. So I realize that there's two layers there of there's the borrower and the lender, but that's why interest rates go up and down. And when the Federal Reserve lowers interest rate, what it's doing is it's really just allowing more money to be loaned out. There's more money entering the market to get loaned out. That's why it's at a lower interest rate, because it lowers that competition, it raises the competition in the lenders and lowers it with the borrower. So when people are talking about buying a house and they say it's a seller's market, well, that usually means interest rates are low because it's easier to buy the house. So more people are trying to do it. Okay. I realize I went longer than just a moment. Let me jump in. So let me hand it back to you.
The easy way to understand this is if you buy a bond and it's paying $50 a year in interest, whatever size bond you bought, and there's another bond that's paying $60 a year in interest, the one that's paying 60, in other words, the higher interest rate, is the one you'll migrate to. If the $50 one, and in the process, you'll sell your old bond that was paying a lower interest rate. So as interest rates rise, people sell their bonds that are
lower interest rates,
and the market falls. For example, the Vanguard Total Bond Market
Admiral
Fund.
Let's say
Admiral.
We're not recommending this. We're using this as an example because they are broad based, and there's not a good bond index to really track.
Because it is actually paying a couple. The coupon on those bonds is a couple of percent because they're longer bonds that date back to before. Interest rates got really, really low. But year to date, your return there with all interest reinvested would have been negative 2.14%, which if you're taking money out and you're saying, I'm taking money out because I want to live on the growth or interest or whatever from this bond fund in this broadly diversified index.
It's hard to live off of negative interest.
Yeah. And as a result, you'd probably be really unhappy if interest rates continue to rise, you're probably going to remain unhappy. It actually peaked in mid-2020, dropped into March and went back up, and it's dropping again now. And bonds are going down as interest rates go up. Now, I won't go so far as to predict what interest rates are going to be in a year, but if the Federal Reserve, which they have suggested they're going to do, stops buying bonds on the open market, because there's a reduction in demand, obviously the demand falls, the price of the bonds should fall, interest rates will go up, and if you own a bond fund or a longer-term bond, you probably will see some relative unhappiness as the value comes down. That is one of the things we're facing.
Let me decomplicate that a second. When the Federal Reserve is buying bonds, they're putting money out into the market. It's that thing. If there's more money in the market, there's more ability to loan. More banks have money to loan. More people have money to loan to the government. So that forces interest rates down across the board. There's more money to loan, so they're in competition with each other. No, I want to make the loan. No, I do. I'll lower my interest rate. And that's what's happening.
But we,
once that stops,
we see interest rates go up. Yeah,
once we see the buying stop, there's less money being flushed in and there's less competition to make a loan. So they don't have to lower their interest rates when they're negotiating with you because it's my way or the highway, that concept. Okay.
And the other indicator that we follow for the economy, West Texas Intermediate Crude Oil, or WTI as it's known, also rose. It rose about 10%. It rose about 5% for the week. It's at $79.40. It's just below $80 a barrel. Now, remember, a little over a year ago, it was negative 35 for a short period of time, and it has remained very low. And this is significant. We don't track the price of natural gas, but it's been going up rather rapidly, too. As a matter of fact, it's gone up quite a lot. There is a shortage of natural gas and petroleum across the world right now, and the price is going up. There's some we can talk about that separately, but the bottom line to it is just as it looks like there's a fairly high probability the interest rates will rise over the next year or so and the value of bonds will decline, there's also a significantly likely probability that the price of fuel and natural gas will rise.
Yeah.
Now, what does that mean to you? It's a very practical meaning. In Texas, we generate almost, not all, but almost all of our electricity from burning natural gas. And the companies that burn natural gas to generate the electricity have the ability to tack on extra fees, extra charges to their electric, what they charge for electricity, if the price of fuel goes up, and the price of fuel is going up. So if you're thinking about renewing your electric contract, it might be good to take a look at that at this point, because there's a lot of indications that the price of gas is going to continue to go up. It's in critical shortage in Europe. They really don't have enough to make it through the winter.
China's switching over to natural gas, yeah, and they're having trouble because there's not enough to go around, and they're having trouble moving their coal around, which is causing coal prices to go up at the same. Basically, energy prices are going up across the board.
And so that's something that's very practical that you should be paying attention to, because it will affect when you go to renew your electric contract by which you buy electricity. If you wait until the prices go up to renew it, you may not be real happy about the result.
Now, on the flip side of that, so that's the micro version of economics, right at the personal level of the majority of you listening are going to be impacted by that. We're also, you said this, we live in the state of Texas. Texas is one of the number one places for natural gas in the world. So even though our gas prices are going to go up, there's going to be more money running around Texas than there was before, which is going to cause more jobs to be made, more income to be made. So even though our prices are going up, the overall benefit to most people in Texas is going to be positive, and likely to most people in the United States as well.
Because you're an exporter of natural gas.
Right. So that is it, is that there is a pain, expect it when you go to pay your electric bill.
Or buy fuel.
But in the background, you're at least slightly, but maybe even more than slightly, more likely to get a raise in the near future because of it. So there you go. There's the good and the bad. And the ugly. And that's the two of us that are ugly are the ones telling you this. So the good and the bad and the ugly. There we go.
So that's what's going on in the markets. And basically, and I mentioned this before, but I think it's important to recognize, there's a lot of indications that last year, in the middle of the year, about July or August, we saw interest rates hit their bottom. And they have been rising ever since. And as a result, the bull market in bonds that has been going on for 40 years is likely over at this point. And that's bold in the world of economic and interest rates. I just made a very bold statement.
Very bold.
And the bold statement is that we've seen the end of a bull market in bonds. And calling the end of a bull market, or calling the beginning of a bear market, or whatever, or
very
the end
hard
of a bear
do.
Market, it's a hard thing to do. But interest rates, unless there's something extraordinary goes on, which I don't think is going to happen in the near future in the United States.
Yeah, nothing weird ever happens here. Wait a minute.
Interest rates don't go below zero. Now, I will say all bets are off if the Treasury defaults. Well, wait a minute. If the Treasury defaults,
it goes up.
Interest rates should go up. So
just as a side note, we saw a spike in interest rates on the maturing note or bills coming up for this month. A spike in interest rates. They usually, bills are very, very short term, and they usually are very, very, very low interest rate. Like 0.1 or something right now, a little bit higher sometimes. And they tend to pay a little bit more than a bank account, but it's not a big risk. It's a short-term loan. You don't get a lot of interest rate for that. Well, for those people that get those, the reason why they make the short-term loans is they actually need the money at some time relatively short-term. So they can only loan it out for a little bit. When the government says we might default, that caused interest rates in this month's maturing bills to go from right in the very, very low 1/10% range to almost 1.5% for a couple of days. So it already was disturbing the market in that these people actually need that money. So they were selling it to someone else to get the money out of it, but they had to raise the interest rate that they were willing to pay on top of what the government was paying. And they do that by discounting the price. And that's how the interest rate goes up. They're like, all right, I'll take less than what I paid for it, even though it's going to mature right away. The government may not pay me, but I need the money, so you give me the money, and I'll pay a little bit extra for that. I'll get less money back than I put in. So there are people who already had loss of money because the government almost defaulted. Just hold that in mind. We've got a couple of questions that have been waiting for days for this radio program.
Poor things.
Yeah, we've got Don... who I should give a nickname. We gave Inquisitor John a nickname. Don is kind of our saint. He's been recording our radio program for over a decade. There have been multiple times that we had recording issues at both the studio and our private recording service. And we sent out the request for help. And so far, every time, Don has jumped up and said, "Hey, look at me over here. I've got it." So thank you, Don, for that. You deserve more credit than we can give on that. We appreciate it. But he's got a extremely good question. He has recently upgraded to a new computer, and he likes to buy the absolute top-of-the-line computer when he buys it, because he's the kind of guy that does the math and says this is the best way to keep the money for longest because it lasts the longest that way. So he renews his computer, he says, every 8 to 10 years. But he buys the top of the line so that it'll last that long. And when you do the math on this, by the way, he's absolutely correct. This is the most cost-effective way of doing it, barring Windows 11 coming out and saying you can't use your computer anymore. So... there's always some issues with technology, but this is a really cost-effective method. Well, he needed to renew, rebuild, recreate, start from scratch, and he did it right in the middle of the worst part of the chip shortage. And it was expensive. And one of the most expensive parts was the video card. The video card can make some money for him. And this is his question. He's totally in agreement with us about the dangers of cryptocurrencies. They're way too volatile. They're all over the place. Some people have made a huge amount of money. Other people have lost huge amounts of money. What does it even mean? What does it represent? All these questions about what it is. He's saying he doesn't want to get into speculation, but people are willing to give him money to rent his, it's called a GPU, a graphics processing unit. It is it's the kind of processor that's best designed for creating cryptocurrencies in the method that's used for Bitcoin and about 90% of the other cryptocurrencies out there. So he's making money in Bitcoin and in other cryptocurrencies that actually are being mined in his computer. And he says, what's a good strategy for this? I mean, I don't want to go out and risk my fortune. How much should I sell of this when I make it? Do I hang on to any of it? I mean, it's essentially free money from his perspective. It's helping to pay for his computer because computer parts are really expensive. Well, first off, Don, this is a fantastic idea. And we've talked about this quite a bit in the past in regard to other big booms and bust cycles. This is true in every gold boom ever. The people that tend to consistently make money are the people that are selling or renting the equipment to the people that wish to go out and go whole hog into full risk zone. So what you're doing makes absolute sense. And something important, I'm going to give some history and context in the answer here. In the gold boom of the 1849, the 49ers out in California, you can basically go to any gold boom. What happens at the end of a gold boom is the price of gold plummets. That's how you know it's the end of the boom, I think. It's the bust at the end of the boom. And when the price of gold plummets, it's because people have been making too much of it. Everybody goes, hey, we found gold and it's easy to find. And so everybody runs out there, and gold prices are relatively high at the beginning. And so people are making their fortunes, and people read it in the newspaper, and they all rush out there to do it. The people who consistently make money in those situations are the people that are selling the picks and the shovels, or the beer and the whiskey, or the hotels, or the mobile homes, if you're talking fracking. And a lot of times they're paid in the commodity. This isn't true in oil. The frackers generally don't pay for their beer with a cup of oil. But in the gold booms and in the cryptocurrency boom, it is the case. They do. It's a more transportable form of commodity. So he's being paid in cryptocurrency, and currently he's selling about half of it and keeping about half of it, and he's making some amount of money. He's not clear about how much he's doing, and he says, "Is it a good strategy? What's the best low effort strategy for pulling cash out of something that's generating a fixed amount of sellable product?" You just described a real estate market if you're renting it. It's basically the lease market. If you have equipment that you wish to make money on and you're not using it all the time, you can lease it out. And that's what people do with apartments or with backhoes or with a lot of other things. You have to know that there's going to be a higher amount of wear and tear. This is true on your computer as well. If you're utilizing it, it is going to be used a lot more. So the life expectancy of your computer is probably not 8 or 10 years, but you should be able to buy a newer computer sooner with the proceeds. So just have that in mind. And a lot of times you can sell the computer on the secondary market, just like you can with a backhoe that's been rented out, or anybody that's bought on the used market a rental car. You know what you're getting into, but you also get a discount. You know somebody's treated this hard. And the reason why the miners out there, by that I don't mean kids under 18, and I also don't mean those that work in the coal mine. I mean the people that are virtually somehow mining by renting other people's computers to do it. They're virtually doing nothing. There's a piece of software that's running on a network, and they are paying from their own proceeds. They generally are renting hundreds of people's computers, though. So those networks can make money, and the way they do it is they then distribute the earnings out across the network. You need a lot of computers right now to mine because there's a lot of computers mining. And this is one of those funny things about cryptocurrency, is that the more people doing it, the harder they make the algorithm, which means you need more people doing it. The less people doing it, the easier the algorithm is, which draws more people in to do it, which makes the algorithm harder.
The question is, finally, though, what is crypto? Let's say one Bitcoin.
Uh-huh.
What's its intrinsic value?
Well, intrinsic is one of those words that doesn't make sense when you're dealing with modes or transportation method of currency. Because what's the intrinsic value of an Australian dollar? Well, it's backed by the full faith and credit of the Australian government. Well, what does that mean? Do governments ever default? Yeah.
But
not often.
Not major developed countries.
And they don't like to. So you have that as your intrinsic value in a developed country's currency. You got, I don't think this is going to get devalued because it would be a lot of egg on their face. When it comes to cryptocurrency, you don't even have that. The only people that are trying to maintain the value of it are the people that own it. But the only reason they're owning it is to use it, and to use it, you have to not own it anymore. That's the way currency works. You can save it, but most people don't say, when I die, I want to have as much money as I can. They would rather say, when I die, I want to leave to my children the opportunity to not work. It's not the goal of having lots of money. It's the goal of somebody's going to spend that money. So when you're talking about cryptocurrency, that's not the case. It's much more like baseball cards or comic books. People hoard them to hoard them, and that's what keeps the value up. So intrinsic value in a collector's card is the same as on a cryptocurrency. Intrinsic value on a national currency is collector's value and the fact that they at least have sort of promised to try to keep it from collapsing. So whatever that means. So there's more risk in cryptocurrency, obviously. Anybody could get that. And there's no telling if it's going to be a constant state of affairs into the future. Is it going to be around forever? We don't know. Is any currency going to be around forever? We also don't know, but it's more likely to be around as long as the government is.
There's a interesting article I read about crypto that I thought was interesting, that most major crypto transactions right now are done in Tether, which is another crypto coin, which is pegged to the dollar, $1. And Tether claims, it's based, by the way, offshore. It's not in the United States. It's not audited. It's not. Nobody looks under the covers. But they claim they have $1 of U.S. currency for every dollar of Tether that's out there. However, and they claim to be trading in short-term contracts to make money on those dollars. The strange thing is, Wall Street Journal took a look at that, dug around a little bit, and they could find no evidence that Tether was doing any trading at all. And in fact, no one has ever been able to find any evidence that the $65 billion or so dollars worth of Tether that's out there, and it's actually gone up recently, is backed by any money at all. And the point that the article made, and I think this is pretty foundational, if somebody figured out that the Tether, it doesn't have dollars to back its cryptocurrency, and by the way, theoretically, you can go to Tether and exchange one Tether coin for $1. If anybody ever decided to make a run on the Tether bank, there may not be any or very little dollars there to pay them, in which case they would collapse. And if it collapsed, the article suggested that Bitcoin and the others might follow close on its heels. So there's a lot of risk in Bitcoin. There's a lot of risk in cryptocurrencies right now. And and the risk is very foundational. I mean, the whole thing could collapse in a moment for no particular reason.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things to be concerned about.
Now, and I'm going to say something here. I'm going to throw in some history from Brazil in the 1990s. And people are kind of, what? Cryptocurrency to Brazilian history? Jake, where are you? Okay. You just said Tether is linked to the dollar, but we're not really sure that it is. That's an important statement because confidence and currency go so close hand in hand. Confidence is often more important than reality when it comes to currency. It's weird. And so what am I talking about? The Brazilian real in the late 80s and early 90s was in hyperinflation. And those of you that lived through the 1970s and you experienced inflation in the United States and you say, oh, I know what that's like. No, you don't. Hyperinflation is thousands of percent a year, not tens of percent a year. It's bad. It is, I mean, as bad as it was in the 1970s, magnify that however much you want, in that by the time you get to the bank to cash your paycheck or to deposit your money, it's worthless. It's already not worth anything. So people were going to a barter system. They were fixing prices. The Brazilian government was fixing prices at grocery stores. So grocery stores were shutting down and groceries were being sold on the black market. They lifted the price controls and they had somewhat limited the hyperinflation. They lifted the price controls and the hyperinflation came right back. The Brazilians just didn't believe that the currency was going to have any value in the future. So they spent it as fast as they possibly could on whatever they could so that they could eat, because they experienced thousands of percent. I mean, there's nothing like going to the store with new money and getting nothing back. Well, there was a fantastic lie that was told that wasn't a lie. It's because it was a self-fulfilling prophecy. It's like if, I won't go into what, I'm short on time, so let me get right to this. A group of five economists, American-trained economists from Brazil, went back to Brazil and said to the government and to the central bank, hey, we need a new currency. But when we replace the currency, because this is the whole thing about devaluing the currency, you got to get rid of one currency or replace it with another. But what's to prevent the other one from experiencing the same thing the first one did? So they went a year of requiring all grocery stores to put on two price tags at a time. The price tag in the normal real that was being used all the time and the price tag of the Plano real, the new one that was coming. It wasn't real yet. No, none of them had been issued. But the price tags were put alongside the other price tag, and those the new money didn't fluctuate. Those price tags were there. Of course, the new money didn't exist yet, but it wasn't fluctuating. So all the people in the grocery store, when they looked at the two price tags, one of them stayed the same, and it was clearly marked that this is the new currency, and one of them was in hyperinflation. The numbers were just getting, I mean, they just had to keep going back through the store and relabeling all the prices all day long. That's how they used to do that before barcodes, for those millennials and such that are listening. They used to use stickers. You put stickers on things with the price, and the stickers had to get really, really big. Okay, so at the end of this, after a full year of that, they got rid of the old one and they brought in the new one, and the new one didn't have hyperinflation because people didn't spend it like crazy because it had been stable for a year, and so they thought it was going to be stable, and it was stable. So was it a lie? So, yeah, that's cryptocurrency writ large. Confidence is important. If you lose confidence in Tether, then the stability goes away. If the Wall Street Journal shows that they've been lying, is it a lie? Well, if people think it's a lie, then it is a lie when it comes to confidence, and then the stability goes away. It's crazy. But we got to play some commercials. I'm glad I got to say that, though. Thank you for giving me that opportunity. If you would like to join the conversation, we still have another question that's been waiting for a day. If you'd like to join the conversation with a question, our email addresses in here are jake@tpwc.com or jeff@tpwc.com. That's thepersonalwealthcoach.com. And we'll be back on the other side of these commercials. And we're back with more of The Personal Wealth Coach with Jake and
Jeff
McClure. You still have that lag, so it came. We tried again. Yeah, all right.
Try it again.
With Jake and
Jeff McClure.
We are lagging between us. There's a short delay because of wires and so on. So trying to coordinate with a delay, it's fun.
We have latency.
Yes.
So let's move on to other things.
We have another question, but I also had an update real quick from Don, who we were just talking about. He wanted to give me a couple of more data points to throw out there. And he said that he's making 0.001 bitcoins about every 12 days, and that's between $40 and $50. And he said the card cost him $1,700, and he's running it 50% and not overclocked, because when he overclocked it, He could increase his returns by 15 to 20%, but it increased the electrical cost by 60%. So diminishing returns. So Don, you can tell why we love Don. Don is a is someone built after our own hearts. Thank you, Don.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we've got another question from John. And is tradition from our Inquisitor. He's got a picture of the Wall Street Journal in its paper form that he has emailed to us digitally so that we can look at our digital version, which is different from the paper version, and try to compare. But he says, number one, he realizes it's an opinion piece. And he says that because he's listened to the program long enough for us to know that we don't like opinion pieces, kind of by definition. But this is a pretty financially oriented, somebody saying, this is my opinion about what the future is going to look like based on the central bank tapering. But specifically, two questions. Do we agree with the premise that all asset classes are at risk as the central banks taper? And number two, what can individual investors do to enhance their downside protection? He's got a paragraph circled. Do you have this email as well?
Yeah.
Okay. The paragraph is, no flows are more sizable or more predictable than a big central bank's purchase schedule. As the world's two major central banks prepare to turn off the taps, financial markets are on notice. Frontier assets such as NFTs, frontier asset being cutting edge, absolutely new and crazy, will likely to be the first to fall, according to, I'm reading again. But experience suggests that no asset class is safe from liquidity drought. As the taper tantrum unfolds, investors and asset managers will need all the downside protection they can get. Okay, so the two questions here is, do we agree with the premise that all asset classes are at risk as central banks taper? Let's kind of take a step back. We're not seeing a taper tantrum. We've seen taper tantrums multiple times since the pandemic began, where people thought maybe the central bank, maybe the Federal Reserve would stop the buying of bonds on the market. What is a taper tantrum? Do you want to explain this a little bit?
Well, basically, when the Fed stops buying bonds, in the past we've had some angst in the market. I don't know that we're going to have it this time.
They've already announced that they were going to do it and when they were going to do it. And typically, just the rumor that they might do it would have caused the bond market to have problems.
And the stock market went down, the bond market went down. But I don't think that circumstance that occurred 10, 15 years ago is very, very different today. There's tremendous amount of, and the other thing I would question is a liquidity drought, because there's an absolutely record quantity of cash floating around in the economy right now.
Right. This
if there was a shortage of cash and the Fed stopped pumping cash into the economy, yeah, that would be a problem.
We're both in agreement there. The reality is that we're at an absolute record amount of cash in the system right now, where this person is reacting to the last disaster, the Great Recession. There was a taper tantrum that was pretty bad back then. There were other issues that were problematic that led to a credit freeze where money didn't move around, a real currency drought. There wasn't enough money in the system. And that led to some deflation. We had to, and the Federal Reserve had to jump in and pump a bunch of money into the system. So this person is quite likely was hurt in some way in the last go round. We don't expect to see interest rates jump up into the sky immediately. This is going to be a long process, just like is normal. Interest rate spiking would be because suddenly a great deal of money disappeared. And that happened when Enron collapsed, for instance. It happened when the savings and loans collapse in the 1980s, or anytime a bank fails, money just disappears with that. When people default on their mortgage, money disappears. We're not seeing a lot of that because of governmental influence.
I do think there's some validity in what he said. I don't think
absolutely. I agree.
The total, every investor is in danger. What I do think is what he refers to as NFTs, net fungible tokens.
Yeah.
Yes. Anyway, the whole point is some of the weird stuff, including Bitcoin that's out there, is being funded by a lot of excess cash, and the excess cash is liable to go away in the near future. And that we're very cautious. I'm particularly very cautious about that. But we're out of time for the first hour.
Downside risk that anybody can do is have money in the bank below the FDIC coverage. So $250,000 in the bank covered by the FDIC. If you've got more than that, use more than one bank. And we're about out of time for this hour. We'll be back. There's more to cover on this. We didn't really touch on his second question very much. But if you'd like to actually talk to us off the air, we give fiduciary investment advice to people of high net worth, and we manage portfolios for them. Our contact information locally, the phone number is
254-947-1111.
There's real live people during the weekend or during the week and voicemail during the weekend. You can reach that line toll free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. Or you can go to our website, thepersonalwealthcoach.com. Or tpwc.com. You can leave us a message through the contact form. You can read our newsletter, sign up for it there. You can download our radio program going back lots of years. You can get our podcast anywhere you look. Until next hour, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.